here on a beautiful Friday afternoon. Big thanks to SML, the guys over there, for helping make this possible. We started talking about this, I guess, about 3 months ago or 4 months ago, and I really just thought, like, who are all the biggest, like, people that have played a part in my recovery, and literally just asked every one of those people to come here and be a part of this, and it's really worked out, and a couple people weren't able to make it, but for the most part, it's going to be a really exciting weekend. I think some really, really cool stuff's going to happen. We do have, obviously, food and drinks for anybody that wants anything. Tomorrow, we will have pizza for dinner. Supper, whatever. If you're from Augusta, we have it for supper. But there are no pads and pens and highlighters. If anybody needs anything, we just ask that, you know, you obviously could keep the notepads, but try not to abuse, like, 50 pens, you know. Don't chew on them. So with that, we're going to open up with a couple-minute meditation. And then somebody's going to read the set-aside prayer back there. Thank you, guys.
Dear God, please set aside anything I think I know about myself, about my disease, about the Big Book, the 12 Steps, the program, the fellowship, the people in the fellowship, and all spiritual terms, especially you, God, so that I may have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. Please help me see the truth.
Amen. Amen.
All right. How you guys doing? My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Carl.
This is my buddy.
I'm Tarek. I'm an addict.
Hey, Tarek.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate Miles inviting us to come and do this. We've been tasked with the first step, which, based on my experience, is really the step that kind of drives the rest of the steps. I don't want to say it's any more important than the 10th step or it's any more important than the 12th step because I don't think it is. But it really is the step that sets the tone for the whole process to unfold, you know. This knowingness of my powerlessness and the unmanageability of my life will determine really everything after that, right? And I say that out of my own experience as someone who spent a lot of time in the rooms having really no understanding of the first step and wondering why I could never finish the steps, you know, why when I got to an inventory I stopped, or why when I read an inventory I didn't do anything after that, right? Looking back on my experience, it's because I never truly understood what powerlessness was or what unmanageability look like, you know. And the only way to find out is to look at your own experience, right? And you're the only one that can do that. You know, they lay out all these chapters to look at this stuff, but at the end of the day, the thing that I didn't understand is that's their experience, right? That doesn't necessarily mean it's my experience, you know? And until I started to ask myself some questions, I never knew, you know? I kind of read this book like, well, I guess you kind of got to swallow it all. Everything has to be your experience or nothing's your experience. And that's not my opinion at all, right? I've definitely read this book, and there are definitely some things that I'm like, I've never done that. Right? There's some stuff with Bill that I'm like, I don't have any idea what that's like. Right? And that's okay, you know? But I didn't know that until I started asking myself those questions and actually looking at my experience rather than just reading this book or listening in meetings, just trying to relay information and one-liners and things like that. So as we approach this stuff, it's important for everybody to ask yourself these questions. Is that true for me? Did I do that? Did I feel that way? Is that what happened to me? Right? Because I think that the power really unfolds in the experience. Right? I don't think any of us really got any real relief or any real fun or anything like that reading about cocaine or looking up on the internet about cocaine or listening people talk about cocaine, you know. I got off doing cocaine, you know what I mean? And same with alcohol, and it's the same with these steps. We can listen about them and we can talk about them, and that's all great, right? But until we start asking ourselves these questions and looking at our own experience and actually working these steps, that's when it actually comes to fruition for me. So if we're to approach the first step as far as the big book is concerned in chronological order, the first thing that they talk about is powerlessness physically, right? And I'm sure most of the people in this, you know, in this room understand this idea or have heard this idea of a physical craving. And the big book talks about that. The doctor watched these guys and he came up with this idea that possibly that their bodies react different than, let's say, other people. You know, and they talk about normal, right? And you'll hear that room talked about, you drink normal.
Yeah.
And I don't know what normal is entirely, but as far as drinking is concerned, what they're talking about is someone who drinks with control. That would be what they consider normal, right? And that's the key factor here when you're looking at powerlessness, loss of control, right? Can you control the amount of whatever it is that you're up against, or can you not, right? What's your experience, you know? And some people will look at that and have a number of things that they're powerlessness over. But the vast majority of people, in my experience and the time that I've had with guys, will pretty much be narrowed down to one or two things, right? When we really look at loss of control, right? The big book uses a couple chapters to describe this, right? There's a line in here that I think does a wonderful job. It's in the doctor's opinion, and it's better than anything that I could ever state. So I'll read it. It's in Doctor's Opinion. It's XXV, the last paragraph. It says, "I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is an entirely a problem of mental control. I've had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to that date, and the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that an important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape, they were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control." So, I'll give you an experience of what that looks like for me. I was living in Denver, Colorado at the time, and as the result of my drinking and using, I was short to pay on my rent. And so they evicted me. And they evicted everyone that lived in that apartment, right? And they gave us a day that we had to have all our stuff out, right? And I had every intention, right? So I knew that we had been kicked out of that place because of me. There was no delusion about that. There was no delusion of me pointing the finger at anybody else. I knew that I got us evicted, and I felt bad about that. And I had every intention of going to the house that day and not only getting all my stuff out, which I wanted my stuff, and I was also going to help clean it so that we didn't get in any more trouble or whatever, and mainly to try to help these guys out because I had screwed them over. And I had every intention of doing that. And the day before, I remember going over to a friend's house, and I started drinking. And the next thing I know, I came to 5 days later, right, all the way across town with a dead phone and a bunch of messages telling me, you know what, you know what I mean, where are you, I can't believe you did this, blah, blah, blah. Just so you know, all your stuff is outside on the curb, blah, blah. And I lost everything I had that day, you know. Everything was gone. But I'm telling you right now, I had every intention of being there, right? Just like it said, the important appointment that I was set, I knew what time I needed to be there. I knew that I needed to be there before this. And I wanted to be there. I really did. And I took a drink. And I started using cocaine, and all of a sudden, I couldn't stop, right? Even though I wanted to stop, right? And this is an important factor, and this is something that I never really understood about this idea that once, and you hear this all the time, once an alcoholic starts, he can't stop. Once he starts, he can't stop, right? But notice that line right at the end where it said, these men were not drinking to escape, they were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control, right? I promise you, my theory, and we're going to get into this a little later, I believe that a lot of us do drink to escape, for sure, right? But I'm going to tell you right now, 3 days into this run, 5 days into this run, there was no escaping. There was nothing going on. I wasn't getting any more high than I was the day I started, right? I was drinking to overcome a craving beyond my mental control, right? Who's ever had the experience when you're using and your mind is telling you to stop using? I don't know if any cocaine addicts have ever had that where your heart's about to blow and you're just sitting there like, don't do it. Like, you gotta stop, you gotta stop. But yet you keep using, right? Or heroin addicts or alcoholics, whatever, right? That's what they're talking about, right? That even though you want to stop, you can't stop, right? And that's a pretty scary place to be, right? And that's why so many of us die, right? It's not because we're crazy. It's because some of us literally cannot stop, no matter the consequences, no matter how much we want, right? No matter how much our bodies are literally telling us to stop, we literally cannot stop, right? And that's what powerlessness looks like in my own experience, right? But I'm going to tell you again, and this is so important, I didn't want to do that. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not a bad guy, you know? And I promise you, I didn't want us to get kicked out of that apartment. I can't tell you how many times I had the money for rent, and I planned on giving it to him, and it just never quite made it to him. You know what I mean? I literally would have the money, and I'm planning on giving it to him, and the next thing I know, all of a sudden, I'm driving down the road, and I'm drinking, and I just can't stop drinking, you know? Like I said, I have every intention of stopping drinking, but I can't stop, you know? I'll read one more thing. You got anything on that, Terry?
One thing with the physical craving or phenomenon of craving, there's a line in the doctors doctor's opinion where he says this explains things we could not account for. So for years, I would be like Carl. I'd be stuck in a hotel. I'd pack my stuff up, and I'm thinking, my mind's making a decision, I'm not going to go see the dope man anymore. And then for some reason, and my stuff's all packed up, and I end up back at the dope man. But I, for years, thought I was making a decision to end back up at the dope man. And then when the runs would get really severe and catastrophic and create a huge amount of collateral damage, what would happen is I'd start to believe that my moral compass was broken. I'd start to believe some really awful things about myself. I would believe the things that people were saying about me, that I really was a piece of shit. And I intentionally was hurting people. But when you understand from your own experience, because your experience tells the truth, your experience is the reality, you cannot argue with experience. And just look at your experience and line it up against what Carl described. But I'll tell you, when I finally understood out of experience what it meant to be physically powerless, I finally had an explanation for things I could not account for. Why didn't I show up at all those family events I was supposed to be at? Right? Why in the middle of the run am I robbing, cheating, stealing, lying, doing all the things to keep the run going? Right? Why am I spending other people's money? But for years, there was a lot of guilt and shame associated with all the things that I would do to keep the run going, thinking I was mentally deciding to do those things, not understanding that I was using to overcome a craving beyond my mental control. Okay, so I've been in Las Vegas for, this was 2005, in Vegas for 5 days. I stay up the entire time in Vegas. Got some money waiting on me when I get home. Girlfriend and I land. Go to my house. I want to grab my money and I want to go down the North Avenue and Boulevard, right? I'm literally throwing bags down, get my money. I'm walking out the door, and granted, my mom, couldn't tell you that time how long it's been since my mom's talked to me, but her car pulls into the driveway and blocks me in. And I'm in the middle of it. There has been no sober breath in this span on this run, okay? Pounding drinks and eating Xanax bars on the plane. Trust me, I am not sober at this point. I'm still under the influence. Mom tries to stop me. So here's what I did. I called my mom the C word, and I got a Dirt Devil vacuum cleaner, and I threw it at her head as hard as I could because she was trying to cut the beast. She was trying to put the beast to sleep, and the beast doesn't sleep until the beast wants to go to sleep. The fire when we activate that abnormal physical reaction, I describe it like a fire lighting up inside of me, and the fire burns and feeds on itself until it's done burning and feeding on itself. And so what did my mother try to do that day? She tried to cut the beast. She tried to put the fire out, and it wasn't going to happen. All right? So I did what I had to do to keep going. So what happened as a result of that, for a long time, the amount of guilt and shame I would experience in my mother's presence was massive. But when I finally understood what Carl just finished describing, I finally woke up to this idea that I believe is true, that I couldn't have done any different. So I believe that if you're sitting in this room and you truly understand a first step, you shouldn't have any guilt and shame around what you did, because when we say the word powerlessness, that means you didn't have a fucking choice. Do you guys get that? That's what happens when you're stripped of power. That means you're under the influence of another power that's driving you. And when you wake up to that, you'll get free of guilt and shame. I'm not saying you're not responsible, and I'm not telling you to go make an amends and try to describe what I just did to someone you're making an amends to. You think my mom wanted to hear that I activated a fire, and that's why I threw the that's why I threw the Dirt Devil vacuum cleaner at her head and called her the C word? That's not what went down in my amends. I took full responsibility for my life and explained to her how I regretted what I had done and I was wrong and I wanted to do what I could to make things right. But for you as an alcoholic and addict, you gotta understand what lack of power is. The first principle behind the first step, those bullshit principles that they like to use, that people love to work instead of the steps, they work the principle behind the step. It should be hopelessness for the first step, or desperation, not honesty. Hopelessness, because what Carl and I want to do is, when we're done up here in a little while, we want to leave you guys as hopeless as fuck. So when Brandon and Elric sit down here, they can present you with some hope. Our deal is, we want to make you guys feel as hopeless as possible. Okay?
One of the things that Tarek talks about, which is really important, was this idea of not having a choice. Right? And this is something that gets really confused. And I can totally understand why it gets confused. And I think there's just such a belief system that, like, we all choose, and we're all choosing, and everyone has a choice, and, you know. And that may be true in a lot of respects, but I'm telling you right now, it's impossible to admit powerlessness and also say that you chose in the same sentence. They completely contradict each other, right? And that's where the hopelessness comes, is really seeing. And this is the step that will thrust you into the rest of the steps, when you really start to see that you're powerless. That you don't know when you're going to stop. Like, when I looked at my experience, I really didn't know when I was going to stop. Right? But for so long, I really believed that I knew when I was going to stop. Even though my experience was to the contrary, right? And we'll get a little into that in a sec about the delusion and things like that. But like Tarek was talking about, one of the reasons why I used to get so down on myself and beat myself up was because I did. I really did. Deep down, I believed I was a bad choice maker, right? And I couldn't help look around at certain people that I knew, and I didn't understand why their reaction was so different than mine. You know, we're buddies. Why can't I stop like him? You know, because I knew all kinds of people. I remember living in Tucson, Arizona, and I lived with a guy, and we would party, and he would do cocaine, but for whatever reason, he would always stop. You know, I mean, he liked the effect produced by it. But I'm going to tell you right now, the effect produced for cocaine for me and him were night and day difference. Completely different, you know. And that's also a factor that I truly believe differentiates an alcoholic from a non-alcoholic, or a cocaine addict from a real cocaine addict, right? And that is the effect produced, right? One of the reasons that I continue to go back for me to cocaine and alcohol and methamphetamines is because the effect produced, right? They do something for me that they don't do for everybody else, right? Or for a lot of other people, right? And one of the ways that I really connected the dots on this is when I started to look at my own experience, because I have a lot of experience with other drugs, but I'm not powerless over a lot of those drugs, right? And one of the main ones that I had looked at that was overly obvious was opiates. I have experience with opiates, but opiates did nothing for me. Almost nothing, right? My experience with opiates was I was trying to get off cocaine, and the logical thing in my head was, well, I'm so tired of going up, I'll go down, you know? And that made sense to me. And it helped, and it worked, you know? For periods. But at the end of the day, the effect produced by opiates, it did nothing for me. It did nothing, right? I never kept going back to the dude's house. I never did whatever I do to get more, right? When it was gone, it was gone. But I would never spend a dime on it. You know what I mean? And why is that? Well, because I'm not an opiate addict. That's why, you know? But the funny thing is, I have experience to the contrary with the other three things that I talked about, right? And one of the main ways that I started looking at that around powerlessness was one of the most obvious that I just totally was completely clueless on was this idea is, why do I continue to go back over and over and over and over, right? And this has a lot to do with what I was describing earlier about my intent. Right, and this is very important. Right, so one of the questions the guy would even ask me sometime, like, you know, you're going to come back. Why don't you just buy more? No, I'm not coming back. No, this is all I want. You know, or maybe that's all the money I had. Right, but at the end of the day, I promise you, I never went on a run and was like, I'm going to stay up for the next 5 days, and I'm going to spend every ounce of money I have and every ounce of money anyone else have, and I'm going to steal from everyone around me and blah, blah, blah. Like, that never happened, right? My intention when I went to that ATM that one time and went over to the dude's house, that was my intention. I was just going to get that much, and here we're good. But for some reason, 30 minutes later, I'm going back, right? And, you know, when I remember when I was living in Denver, my guy kind of lived across the city, and it's not exactly a skip and a hop away. And all of a sudden, I'm driving back and forth, back and forth. It's like, logically, it's like, well, why wouldn't you just buy it all at once? Well, because the truth is I never intended on doing that, right? I intended on getting high, absolutely. I knew what I was doing, but I never intended to 5 days later come to and be completely destroyed, you know? One of the things, too, I want to touch on, which is really important because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about this around the first step specifically, and that is alcoholism and drug addiction is an internal condition, right? It has nothing to do with your outside circumstances, right? What you do on a run is what you do on a run, right? But it doesn't have anything to do with alcoholism and drug addiction, right? I believe if you're an alcoholic, then all alcoholics can identify on everything, right? And when we start to look at this internal condition, I've yet to meet an alcoholic or an addict that can identify on that, right? But when I start to look on some of the things that I did when I used and some of the things that I did when I drank, I've definitely met some people that have done some of those things. And I've also met some people that haven't done some of those things, right? And the reason that is because those things don't have anything to do with what we're doing here, right? Those stories can be interesting as far as identifying with each other. Like, oh, yeah, that's cool. You did that. I did that. Oh, I've been there. Blah, 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 right? But at the end of the day, this is an internal condition, right? And the more emphasis that we can put on that, the easier it is to connect, right? Because one of the things that it's real easy to do is to look at outside circumstances and start to separate ourselves, right? Well, you know, you did that, well, I never did that, or I did that, and you never did that, or blah, 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 right? And what happens inevitably is we're little by little separating ourselves based on things that have nothing to do with alcoholism and drug addiction, right? The only thing they have anything to do with is at times alcoholics will do those things and sometimes alcoholics will not do those things, right? But it doesn't have anything to do with actual alcoholism, right? You got anything else?
Yeah. you know, I know there are a lot of people here that are in some type of program and we're holding you captive today, so I get it. I'm going to share something with you, give you a couple nuggets to take home with you. The degree to which you experience your first step at a gut level will determine the degree to which you think treatment is a goddamn game. And just see how much you can get away with. All right? I know this because I work in this industry. And when someone has a first step that's worked on them, that causes them to be surrendered, they'll see the grave nature of their problem and they'll be willing to do things that they were not willing to do before, and treatment will not be a game. All right, let me see how much I can get away with and talk and send these text messages and hang out with these girls if you're a guy and vice versa and, you know, not be where you're supposed to be at. It all hinges on this, what we're talking about. Do you see that when you intend to do things, what you intend does not happen? So you've been stripped of control. And if you're stripped of control, you're stripped of power. And if you're stripped of power, you're stripped of choice. And you will come to the first step in two forms. You could be in denial, right? Deny implies a choice, though. Deny implies rejection, right? It really comes from a place of looking at your options and you're going to deny or accept what you're looking at after you weigh it out. Some people, they deny their addiction. they're still delusional, because I think that's the core problem with alcoholics and addicts, the delusions that drive us underneath, right? You know, this, I was really bad off on this substance, but it's going to be okay if I do this substance, right? It was because I lived in this part of town, so if I live over here, that'll be the solution, right? It's because I hung out with these people. It's because I was molested when I was 5 years old. That's why I'm an alcoholic and addict. Wait, I was abandoned when I was 5 years old, so that's why I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, right? Not the case, because I know several people over the course of my time here outside of this program that were affected by those life situations the same way I was, and they did not become an alcoholic and a drug addict. So it can't be the drama of where your addiction takes you or your alcoholism takes you, and it can't be the drama that you went through when you were a kid. And I don't, maybe drama is the wrong word. The pain and the suffering that some things create in our lives, and we become really identified with them. But when you're able to see this, that it has nothing to do with circumstances, that it's entirely a problem of control and powerlessness and not having a choice. And so when you see that, working steps 2 through 12 is rather easy. When you don't see it, it's like climbing Mount Everest. Right. But for years, it was really difficult for me. I could see that once I started smoking crack, all bets were off. Right? I knew it. I knew something happened to me that was messed up, that I didn't have the words. I didn't, you know, when we're out there using, before we get to the steps, it's not like we throw around the word spiritual malady and phenomenon of craving and other words that we use in the room so readily. Right? I just knew something was messed up once I started smoking crack. Right, I did a lot of heroin and I smoked a lot of meth and I loved OCs, but I'm telling you, I am a crack cocaine addict. It's clear as day. Like Carl described, you know, if they came across my path, I'd buy as much as I could. But when they were gone, I did not turn into seek and destroy mode for any substance other than crack cocaine. That's mine. That's my experience. That's my truth. Does it mean I can do any of the other substances? Absolutely not. But for years, I didn't understand this idea of not having a choice before anything was in my body. What do you mean I don't have a choice? That doesn't make any sense. Of course I have a choice. And then I'm sitting at this man's big book study. This guy, he's one of my heroes. His name is Dante, and it's on page 24. It's probably the paragraph in the book that has changed me more than any other paragraph, because it was a source of inspiration. It says, the fact is that Tarek, and it says most alcoholics, which means it's not all of them, most of them, and most addicts, for reasons they don't understand, reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink and drug. Tarek's so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. Tarek is unable, and these are the three most important words, at certain times, to bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of a week ago, a month ago. When you're dealing with drugs like dope and crack and meth, I mean, we're talking 8 hours ago. We are without defense against the first drink or drug. And so I'm sitting there, and Dante says the three most important words in that paragraph are at certain times. And then he followed it up by saying, and do you, any of you know when that certain time is going to come for you? And what hit, the light went off for me was, holy shit. I don't know. That means I have to do this like I smoked crack. Because one of the most fascinating things to watch is, because we love drama, right? We want to prove to everyone we have the best war story, or we're the sickest person in the room, or we're the wellest person in the room. I've watched these individuals that will talk a nasty game about what they did out on the street. But when it comes to working these steps, forgive my language, they turn into a bunch of little pussies. And it's fascinating to watch, and it's very sad to watch. I am very grateful that for whatever reason, the mentality I had on the street followed me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous. And that is not my doing. I received that as a gift that was granted to me. But when Dante said those words, that's not that night, it did something to me, because I have to say it created a little bit of fear. And I don't know if the fear would have, kept me motivated. But what it did was it did thrust me into another deeper course of action. And so now you're thinking to yourself, what does he mean that he lost the power of choice? I'm gonna describe to you a common 24-hour period when I was in my addiction. I stayed up all night smoking crack. I am tweaking out at this point. It's about 4 or 5 in the morning. So what do? I take a Klonopin, eat a couple footballs, eat a couple bars. I got to start to calm down because I got to be at work at 8 o'clock. And I'm an analyst at this point. I mean, I thought I had arrived. I had a corner office. I had a putting green in my office. You know, I worked for a bunch of bank executives. I mean, I really thought I'd made it. I was going to become the weekend crack warrior that killed me. You know, that was one of the delusions because, like Carl, I had friends that could rage Friday and Saturday night, go sleep all day Saturday, and then go be lawyers and successful business people throughout the rest of the week. And I'm a smart guy. I'm not an idiot. Why can't I do what they're doing? So there's a delusion. One day I'm going to be able to do what they're doing. But the effect produced in them was quite different than the effect produced in me. And so I tweak out, I smoke a bunch of cigarettes, I take a shower, I put my work clothes on, I drive to work. And my whole agenda was get by the receptionist without making eye contact so I could get to my office, close the door, put do not disturb on the phone, and just not be bothered until usually by 9 or 10 o'clock, I'm not tweaking. My eyeballs are not popping out of my head anymore. And I can engage someone and have a halfway decent conversation. And so what would happen would be around 10 o'clock, 10:30, I get this vision of this big 20 rock on the end of a stem and taking that blast. And I shake it off. I shake it off and I say to myself, I spent too much money last night. I got mom's birthday coming up this weekend. I got so-and-so's thing I got to be at. I got rent due. I owe Kevin money from last month for bills. That is an intellectual sorting out process I just described to you. So the word choice comes from that, right? When I woke up this morning and I went to the gym, took a shower, and I looked in my closet, there was a bunch of shirts I wanted to wear, and I examined my options, and I accepted or rejected. I rejected a bunch of stuff, and I accepted what I'm wearing. That's a choice. It comes from a position of neutrality. Okay, so, but what I just described to you in the office was sort of an intellectual sorting out process, because what I did was reject. I rejected it. I pushed it away. I said, okay, I got this. So what happens is for the next few hours, there's nothing going on. But then it comes again, right? Except now I'm the visions are so strong, it's affecting me physically, right? To that point, physiologically, I am being affected by the vision of crack cocaine in my head. And I go through the intellectual sorting out process again, and I'm victorious, right? I have access to my willpower. See, then around 3:30 or 4 o'clock, my boy downtown on North Avenue and Boulevard will send me a text and he says, I got something for you, right? And the intellectual sorting out process even works then. And now it is 5 o'clock and I have won. It's the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon, right? And I go walking to the parking garage. I get into my car. I am driving home and I get to this damn traffic light. And I can go straight and go home, or I take a left and go downtown. That intellectual sorting out process that I had access to all day long was unavailable to me. At certain times, our willpower is unavailable to us. We're without defense against the first thought. Boom, I go. I go. That's what it means. And we're not telling you guys you don't have a choice all the time. But what we're telling you, at certain times, you're not going to have access to that process. And that's what making a choice is all about. It's an intellectual sorting out process. There's a reason that the authors of this book don't use the word denial, except for one time in Bill's story, and it's when he's talking about his conversation with his grandfather and the proffered temperance pledge that he took. It's used in the back of the book in the spiritual experience appendix, I think. It's not used in the rest of the 164 pages in the doctor's opinion, to my knowledge. But there's words like illusion, obsession, and delusion. You can't tell the difference between what's true and false. These are the definitions that the authors of the big book use, the phrases that they use. I don't think that was on accident. Because the word denial, implies choice. You deny something or you reject something. That's the best way I can describe powerlessness when it comes to the mental aspect of this illness. Because the observations that Carl and I made about the physical craving are academic and pointless. The real issue is, why did Tarek and Carl pick up the first one? Why do we attempt the desperate experiment of the first one? Why can't I stay away from it no matter how great my necessity or wish to do so? What that translates into, ladies and gentlemen, is that you're fucked. Okay? And so the rest of what the steps are about is unfucking you. That's what this is about. But you have to see how effed you are in the first step to become willing to take a course of action to become unept in the rest of the steps. But there's a part of the first step that nobody can work. I couldn't work it. Carl couldn't work it. I've been around sponsoring people long enough to know that I've watched people work the, you know, sitting down with a sponsor. Let's look at your experience. Tell me some stories about what happens to you after you start. Tell me some stories about when you chose not to and you did anyway. Tell me when you had an important engagement to keep and you picked up a drink or a drug a day or so before and you couldn't make it to that engagement. But then you get to this concept of being surrendered. Look, I mean, I would have surrendered before the bankruptcy and I lost my home and I was incarcerated. End of story. If I had the power to surrender on my own. But that is a cold, harsh reality, trying to explain that to somebody that surrender is granted. It's not acquired. So I had a lot of praying in my early days of recovery this last time. I bounced in and out for 3 years. Was just like, give me the willingness to keep doing this, right? That's a degree of surrender. The acknowledgement that I couldn't do it. Like, I'm not the source of the willingness. I've been granted the willingness. I've been granted the surrender. And if you're questioning it, the best way to see it really is to look at your actions. That's why I made that comment about playing these games. You know, I've done a lot of these workshops, and I'll see the people sitting in the back, and for whatever reason, this weekend we don't have any, but usually there's a bunch of people on the back wall sitting on their phones. They can't wait to get out of here. This is the last thing on their mind. They don't want to sit up here and listen to the two of us. You know? Is it a game? These are questions that you should ask yourself. Am I surrendered? Well, let's talk about it. What are my actions saying? But you have to look into your own experience and see what we're talking about when it comes to this loss of power. Because if you lose one, you lose all three. You win the triple crown. And it ain't coming back. We're like men and women who have lost their legs. They don't grow new ones, guys. You can't make a normal drinker or a recreational drug user out of one of us, period. Right? But only your experience can abundantly confirm that to you. All Carl and I we're just sharing our version of today and the first step. Right? We may do something completely different with our sponsees, but we're always having these types of conversations. So, I think that pretty much covers the first half of it. And I'm going to turn it back over to Carl, and he's going to start talking about the real problem.
The unmanageability. Me and Tarek have very similar experiences. We were introduced to the idea of powerlessness and really had no understanding of the unmanageability. And this is a problem. The reason it's the problem, it is a problem is because I believe that this is the real killer of alcoholics and addicts is what we're talking about right now. The unmanageability, right? This internal condition, this state of being that makes it very uncomfortable for an alcoholic or an addict to be sober, right? And this is a problem if you're powerless, right? And you have to be sober to live in this world. How are you going to do that? Right. Well, if you're anything like me, you're not going to be able to do that because sobriety is not a great experience. Right. And that's a really, really tough place to be when you start to really make the connection that every time I use, I can't stop, and I don't know what's going to happen. I'm going to die. But every time I'm sober, I want to shoot myself in the head, you know? And that's my experience, right? Is I would get sober, and especially towards the end, the runs were getting really bad, and I had enormous desperations to stay sober, right? I'm talking, I want to stay sober every time is the most time, you know what I mean? I've never wanted to be sober this bad. And I would come off a run, and I would be physically depleted, and I would begin to go through what everyone, the detox, and all of that nonsense, right? And all that brutality of trying to get my body back to healthy again. And I would start to sleep again, and I would start eating again. And so physically, I would start feeling better. But for whatever reason, mentally and emotionally, it would turn on me, right? And I should be so glad to be sober. Oh my God, I'm still alive. But I'm not. Not at all, right? And it starts to get really uncomfortable. The best description I have is that it feels like something's missing, right? Even though you have food, shelter, water, whatever, it's like something's just missing, you know? And you could have a great job, and you could have a great car, and all these things, and all these maybe material possessions, but internally you're just completely coming apart. And that's my experience, you know? When I get sober, that's what happens to me. And I really never made this connection, because when I lived in Denver, no one talked about this. I never heard anyone talk about this. They talked about the powerlessness, but I heard a conversation one time that completely changed my life. And basically the essence of it was, he said that sooner or later, you'll have to come to the realization that just quitting drinking and just quitting using will have no long-term permanent effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. And at that moment, all my experiences came to a head, and it just like flooded my whole life. I literally, at that moment, I don't know if I'd ever identified with any one line in my whole life, because that was my experience to the T. Every single time I try to get sober, is I would get sober based on circumstances, or I get sober based on I wanted to be sober, or whatever. But whatever the fact is, I would find myself sober, and just like it said, it would gradually get so painful that I just couldn't stand it anymore. And sometimes that was a couple days, sometimes that was a couple weeks, or sometimes that was a couple months. But little by little, the state of consciousness that I started to experience sober got worse and worse and worse and worse. And I had no idea what was going on. I figured something was wrong. I need something. I need anxiety. I need antidepressant. I need all these things. Something's not right. I can't, this can't be right. Something's wrong with me, right? And I had no idea that what I was experiencing was what people call untreated alcoholism. I had a condition that was untreated, and it was completely eating me alive. And this is why people with 10 years sober blow their heads off. This is why quite a few years ago, a guy hung himself at 20 years sober. This is why, right? Because he doesn't feel good. He doesn't feel right, right? Something's off, right? What's off? Well, this condition has completely engulfed his life, and he no longer can imagine life with or without alcohol, right? And that's a horrible place to be. You want to talk about a dark, 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 dark place. Right. When you can no longer imagine life with or without this, you know. You got anything?
The big book on page 64 says, once the spiritual malady is overcome, we'll straighten out mentally and physically. It also tells us we've been mentally and bodily ill, we've been also spiritually sick. But the spirit, I don't believe, can be sick. All right. It says spiritually sick. What is that about? You know, I can take a stab at it that I can tell you it's about connection and relationship now. And when I am not conscious of a presence with me and the Creator has not entered my heart, or I don't believe resides there, then I'm going to have problems in personal relationships. There, I'm going to constantly be demanding from you. I'm going to constantly be judging you. I'm going to be hunted by misery and depression. They're going to come looking for me. That's what my mind's going to tell me. Why is this happening to me? I'm going to be full of fear. I'm going to think I'm useless, which to me is the worst place an addict and alcoholic can get to, is when you feel useless. That's why the sponsorship works the way it does, because you can't, if you're active in sponsorship, you can't help but feel useful. You know, that's why we drain the anxiety. It's a real life thing. It is. It's part of being human, folks. You don't need to take a pill. It's cool to be anxious from time to time. It's okay to be depressed from time to time. But what happens when you have a personal relationship with a power greater than yourself, when the bedevilments show up, because I promise you they're showing up for everybody in this room, you will have an answer. You won't feel empty. And you will know that whatever you're struggling with will change you and change who you are and change how you react and deal with the world and in relationships. And it's usually changing you in a really positive way if that's what happens with your second step. And I don't want to get too much into the second step, but that's what, to me, the spiritual malady is about. Sometimes we talk about, like, hey, if page 52 and these bedevilments are in my life, I'm doing something wrong. I don't believe that. They're going to come. That's what my experience in 11 years tells me. But the meaning behind them is what's changing, right? And there's not as much identification with them egoically, and there's, as a result of that, there's not as much overthinking and self-judgment. And as a result of that, guess what? I get to be more gentle on myself, right? Because we are harder on ourselves than anybody else in most cases. Then for a long time, I thought my mental obsession made my life unmanageable. Then I met Carl, and I met Lindsay, and I met my buddy Mike, and I had probably 15 months. And they had recently been exposed to this idea that it's a three-part problem and not two, because for years I just thought it was a two-part problem. I do think addiction and alcoholism involve drugs and alcohol. The part we're talking about right now, the majority of humans on the planet suffer from, right, the internal condition. They're, but the way they treat it's different. We treat it with drugs and alcohol. And so this idea of being spiritually sick, I don't get down with, but having conscious separation from God, I do. And that's what we're talking about here. Now, when you get here, I get it. You guys are in a treatment center. I got it. Unmanageability externally is directly, I mean, day one, that those things are closely related. But the further you get away from day one, you're going to start to see something. That whatever problem is the real problem is still there. Right? And that was when I connected the missing piece, is when I met them and we started getting exposed to these new ideas. And it did become a new journey for me, right? But I know in the early days, your journey has a lot to do with just not using and just not drinking, folks. But here's the reality of it. If drugs and alcohol didn't do so much for you at one point in your life, they would have never done so much to you. So whatever you find here after this conversation is over, you got to ask yourself, am I willing to trust that this process can do something for me similar or greater than what the drugs and the alcohol did for me? Because that's what they treated, was that void and that emptiness that we have. And as a result of that emptiness, what we'll do is we'll suck everything out of the personal relationships. We will judge ourselves into the point of misery and depression. We will feel like we can't help other people. We will be full of fear all the time. And that's why it's a three-part problem. That's why we have that circle and triangle. Recovery, unity, and service. The legacies somehow address the mind, the body, and the spirit.
One of the things that Tara talked about was this idea that we need to treat this condition. This is very, very important, right? And this is another reason why this step will ultimately be the catapult to the rest of the steps, right? Because if my condition doesn't get treated with this process of the 12 steps, it's going to get treated by something, right? That's just my experience. Eventually, my mind is going to take me right back to cocaine, right? Well, why would it do that? Well, because it knows that when I use cocaine, I get ease and comfort, right? And that's what I need at those moments. And I will have no choice in the matter. Right? You can, if you're an alcoholic or an addict, you can think you have a choice all you want, but you don't. Right? And this is why working the steps is so, so important. Because the unmanageability is a very real thing, right? It's a very real thing. And it's something that, just like I described, I really didn't understand what was going on with me. I really didn't. I knew something was wrong with me. But it just had a scratch that I never could really itch when I would be sober. And it was just awful, right? And this is why alcoholics and addicts tend not to stay sober, right? Because they have a condition that they tend not to treat, right? Because just like Tarek said, so many of us come in here and we think just by being sober that our condition is going to get treated, or just by being in a treatment center, or just by being in jail or prison or whatever, we think that that in itself is going to treat us, right? Or just being by sober people or around sober people, or maybe go to a bunch of meetings or get a sponsor and call them every day. These are all things that will not treat your condition if you're anything like me and Tara, right? And I say that because a lot of those things we tried in excess, right? But when I started to work these steps, one of the things that started to happen for me is I started to change internally, right? I say that because my first year sober, externally, not a lot of things got really, really good, quote unquote, right? I didn't get a car, right? I didn't have this amazing high-paying job. I didn't live in this nice house, right? Like, none of those things came to me at all in my first year, right? So, like, but internally, things started to shift dramatically, right? That itch that I had that was just unbearable started to go away, right? And for whatever reason, that feeling of uselessness started to change dramatically, right? And just like Tarek talked about, I think you mentioned the feeling of uselessness. But that started to change, you know? And I didn't really know what was going on, right? But I knew something was happening to me, right? And I just ran with this thing, and I really can't explain it, right? Because I say that as someone who got introduced to the 12 steps, and for whatever reason, a friend of mine sold it to me. I mean, I believed it, right? And he was my first sponsor. And I was surrounded by people that drank like I drank and used like I drank, you know, used like I used, right? And not a single one of them are sober to this day, right? None of them, right? People that maybe even had way lower bottoms than me, right? But at the end of the day, for whatever reason, they never made that connection, right? They never made that connection in the first step. So why would they do all this stuff, right? Like Tarek talks about, if you don't make the connection in the first step, this will seem like Everest. That is definitely my experience. You will pick and choose the things that you decide you want to do that will be at your convenience, right? But if you start to connect to this powerlessness and the hopelessness of the first step, and what that really means is you're going to die. You are going to die the alcoholic or addict death, right? And I don't know when that day will come for you, but that day will come, right? And we've all watched it happen, right? Every single person in this room has probably watched it happen, right? Probably more times than we need to, you know. But at the end of the day, if you will work these steps, I have definitely found a solution to this condition that I'm talking about, a condition that I had no idea would ever go away. I literally believed that I was going to feel like this forever, right? I used to think about killing myself a lot, right? Because I just hated the way that I felt sober, right? And I can promise you, I haven't thought about that in a long time, right? the gift of life is an amazing thing, right? And it's very, very fragile, right? And one of the things these steps have done for me is really woken me to the reality that life really is an amazing, amazing, amazing thing to be a part of, right? These steps will change you in ways that you can't even begin to fathom right now. You just can't. And nor could I when I had a year sober or 2 years sober or 2 days sober, you know. But they will change you. And it's an amazing thing to be a part of. Right? It definitely is.
So there are three views towards recovery and addiction to alcoholism. One view says that we're gonna grab all the alcoholics and addicts, and we're gonna put them in a sober community, and we're gonna resocialize them. Right? If you stick with the winners, you're good to go. Then there's another view that says if I can, you know, if they would have worked with me on therapy, with therapy, which I've been in therapy, I've been, you know, clean and sober almost 11 years. I've been in, if you take all the time I've been in therapy, it's probably close to 5 years of that 11 years I've spent seeing someone. Because I do think it's very valuable, especially when you got a good one that knows the right questions to ask to take you to that dark place you've never wanted to go to. If you tap that trauma, me being molested, and I treat it, and I change the meaning behind it, and then ideas and thoughts about it will not trigger me to get high or drink. And then there's a third view, which is the view we all prescribe, the conversion experience, which is what the 12 steps do. The 12 steps, if taken in their entirety, will create a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism and drug addiction. Period. End of story. I now believe it's a magical combination of all three of those things. I used to wear it like a badge of courage, hanging out with all my friends, going to panic shows in early recovery. And I still go to panic shows, and I still hang out with some of my old friends. But I was having this conversation the other day. There were like 20 to 25 old friends that I hung out with on a regular basis, my old friends. Now that number has dwindled to like 6 or 7. They haven't changed. I've changed. And I hope I continue to change. And what and Carl said the word change several times. And that's what this whole process allows you to do, is get into change. And what happens is your character has to change. And I'm also convinced today that addiction, alcoholism, recovery has a lot to do with character. We're all going to have our shortcomings, and we're going to fall flat on our faces. But there's something in the process of character refinement being changed that is imperative in this process. It's imperative. And what we did today was we tried to lay out in our own words and from our own points of view how the first step works for us and how we teach the first step. I know Carl, I mean, he used beautiful words. I had to cuss a little bit. I'm telling you, you know, one of my heroes, this guy named Big Frank, I'll never forget it. In one of his talks, he says, you know, I only cuss when I got no other words in the English language that can get my point across. Right? And that's why profanity flies out of my mouth sometimes. But I am going to say it again. Your first step has to show you that you're fucked. And if it shows it to you, then you'll become willing to do things to unfuck yourself. That's what the rest of the steps are, 2 through 12. That's what they really do. But as long as you don't see that in the first step, you're just not. It's going to be tedious and arduous and most likely will not be consummated. But here's what the process does require. Because I know we're sending you guys out of here without a lot of hope, which is what we wanted. But I'm going to tell you, if you're going to recover, it's going to require the leveling of your pride, the confession of shortcomings, and for you to think honestly. Search diligently. None of that sounds comfortable, does it? So none of this process is about being comfortable. It can't be. It has to be about the hopelessness of the first step. Because with that, and Carl talks about this a lot, it will dictate and thrust you into the remaining steps. Every step should really take you deeper into. It's like step one, then step two, back to step one. Step three, back to step one. Step four, back to step one. They're all surrenders. That's all it is. It's a series of endless and limitless surrenders in this process. But it all starts with this step. The 12 and 12 says this step is a firm bedrock upon which happy and purposeful lives can be built. Lives. It really is. This is the foundation. The main foundation stone is this first step. The entire foundation. All right. All right. We do have 10 minutes. We'll take some questions, but Carl and I are pretty much done.
Oh, we're going to... I thought we were going to 5:15.
No, we've got 10 more minutes. No. Any questions? Clear as mud.
What point did you realize you were close?
Sitting in that big book study, to be honest with you, when I saw those words at certain times. Yeah. Really, if I think back, now that you asked that question, that night something about me realized, holy, I am. Because I'd been to treatment and in and out for so long, I saw the drama. The drama never proved to me that I was effed. But for whatever reason, when I saw it at certain times, and I have no idea when they are, that did something to me.
Yeah, for me, it was that experience I described of that conversation that I heard. And I would I was freshly sober, and the same thing was going on for me that had always gone on. I'm not from Atlanta. I had the opportunity to come out here early in sobriety, and basically what happened every other time started to happen. I started to get physically better, and then all of a sudden I started to come apart, and it started to show up where I was in this outpatient program, and I would show up kind of when I wanted to show up. I'd show up late all the time, and I would argue a lot. I would make fun of people that were real into this thing, and I literally just started coming apart like I always do, you know. And I don't know, I finally got to the spot where I finally made the connection, right, that this is going to continue to happen, and I'm going to die. You know, that I can't beat this thing, that I've been trying to beat this thing, and I've been suffering from the illusion that next time is going to be different, even though next time was never different. You know? And I finally made that connection that just quitting drinking will have no long-term permanent effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it, you know. And you will always go back for that relief, you know. And I could just see that connection in all my years of drinking and using. All came to a center, or all came to me at that time. And I knew from that point on that I knew I was an alcoholic or an addict, you know. Meaning a threefold, you know. I had no idea. And that experience thrusted me into really the unknown, right? Because I had never worked the steps, right? I had been around a lot. But my experience with AA was a lot of one-liners, right? And when I was getting sober in Denver, I hung out at a clubhouse all the time. And I would just hear one-liners. And honestly, a lot of them made sense to me. You know, I remember I heard that one, like, well, if you don't drink the first one, you won't get drunk. And I remember hearing that, like, oh my God. it sounds so stupid now. But I was like, holy shit. You know, like, I thought it was the coolest saying ever. I remember thinking, like, no fucking shit. Like, another one that I remember this old timer would always, he'd see me, and he was old timer, and he'd always look at me and be like, are you ready to put the plug in the jug? And I remember when he said that, I was like, yeah. And it was just like, put the plug in the jug, you know, like. And this was like going on in my head, but I was like, I just had no idea what was going on. I would just, you know, anything people said, I just, if it made sense, it was just like, yeah. Even though my experience, but I was so delusional, you know, that stuff, like, it was going to have some sort of impact on me, you know. When I finally made that connection, it thrusted me into this process. And again, like I said, it thrusted me into the unknown. I mean, I was entering an experience that I knew nothing about, right? And this is so important, right? Because so many of us, like myself, come here and we think we have to act like we know everything about everything, right? And it's amazing to hear, you know, you'll hear a guy share and it's like, holy cow. And then you talk to him, he's got like 2 days sober. It's like, oh, yeah, man. But you would think he had 20 years sober. And that was me, because I would hear these things and I would think that they were like real. Like, oh, yeah, like, I'm good now. I'm putting the plug in the jug, you know? I'm fucking, yeah, hell yeah, let's go to some meetings. And then I'd be drunk, right? Well, because I didn't really know what I was up against. I really hadn't made that connection, right? But I came out here a guy who thought he knew what to do, right? And I'd been through this, you know, pony show, and I know what to do, and I'll go to some meetings, right? But at the end of the day, I'm going to get my shit together, and I'm going to go back to Denver, and I'm going to live my life, you know? And thank God something happened for me, and I was really just blessed with that experience because it changed me forever, right? But the main thing it did is it thrusted me into the 12 steps for the first time ever, and I did. I worked all the 12 steps, right? Does it mean that on my first pass I made all my amends? No, but I made a lot of amends, right? And in that experience, man, so much changed for me, right? So much changed for me during that time. But again, I can't emphasize the most. The change that I'm talking about is an internal change, right? I cannot promise you that you're going to have a bunch of money and cars and a bunch of girls or guys or any of that side. Like, I have no idea what that. Some of that stuff may come to you, right? A good example. Here's a great example, right? I have a friend of mine who is 3 years sober, and he is just blessed with all kinds of money, and he's got a giant house and cars and all this stuff, right? I've been sponsoring a guy for years who's over 3 years sober, and he sponsors all kinds of guys just like that guy, and he lives in a tiny shack that is probably as bad as any house anyone's ever lived in this place right now, right? But that guy is as free as anyone I know. That guy helps more guys than a lot of people I know, right? Guy doesn't have a car, right? Doesn't have a huge, high-paying job, rides a bike everywhere, right? But that guy is free as hell, man. Yeah. Every time I see that guy, he's got a smile on his face. He's helping people. So again, I can't tell you that you're going to get all this material crap. Right? And I have no idea what jobs are going to come your way or what relationships are going to come your way. But the big book talks about you'll experience a sense of freedom and happiness, right? And I can promise you that'll happen, right? And you'll feel a sense of power flow into you, right? I can promise you that'll happen, right? You'll be able to handle situations which used to baffle you, right? I can promise you that'll happen, right? And these are all internal conditions, right? This is what Tarek talked about, a perception change, you know what I mean? At the very same place, I can't express this part enough, when I moved to Georgia, I hated Georgia. I fucking hated Georgia. I hated everything about Georgia. I hated the accents, I hated the music, I hated the rednecks, I hated everything about Georgia, right? And I just counted the days till I could leave this place and never come back, right? I hated the halfway house I lived in. I hated the guy who was the halfway house leader. Fuck him. And I hated I hated the counselor. I fucking hated her. I just hated everything, and I hated everybody, you know what I mean? And I started working these steps, and little by little, all those things started to change, right? That guy who was my halfway house didn't change. He was still the same guy, right? The lady used to give me shit all the time that I hated, my counselor. She didn't change, right? The heat didn't change. The accents, the blah, blah, blah. Right? All the things that I hated so much, they didn't change. But for whatever reason, the way that I viewed those things and my perception of those things started to change. Now, has anyone ever read the book New Pair of Glasses by Chuck C? And that's a great example. It's a great description of what happened for me. my vision of the very same place that I came out here changed completely, you know. And I'm so grateful for that, you know. But I promise you, that perception change will not just fall on you. It's not just going to come to you, right? You are going to have to do some things that will make you so uncomfortable you won't want to scream. You will literally want to jump out of your seat, jump out of your skin, jump out of a building, right? But if you'll continue on this process, all these things will start to change, right? Everything will change. Your whole life will change completely. Every aspect of your life will change. It's not like we work the steps and these things change and then these things don't change at all. Everything will change. The way that you look and relate with money, the way that you look at with relationships in your life, work, right? This meeting, the meetings, the big book, everything will change. Any more questions?
Yeah, I think we're good.
On that note,
we're out, yeah. Yeah, we're done. Thank you. Woo!